You're listening to Activation Energy by the Chemical Angel Network. I'm your host, Selma Duhovic. In this episode, Halima and I speak with Dr. Martin Mulvihill, the founder of SaferMade, a venture capital firm investing in safer chemistry. Marty has a PhD in chemistry from UC Berkeley and was a postdoc at the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. Before founding SaferMade, he also founded and ran the Berkeley Center for Green Chemistry. Hi, Marty. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's a pleasure to be here today.
Let's dive right in. Can you walk us down your career path?
I'm a chemist by training. So I went to undergrad in Portland at Reed College, where I fell in love with chemistry. I love molecules. I love what everything around us is made of and learning how it all works. And then I went to UC Berkeley for my graduate degree. And that's really when I became passionate about connecting my interest in chemistry with a real interest in serving human and environmental health. And so while I was there, I worked on issues of arsenic pollution and groundwater and looking at making new materials out of bio-based feedstocks. And during that time, I actually started the UC Berkeley Center for Green Chemistry. And that's something that I went on to run for about 5 or 6 years after I finished my PhD. I'm really proud of the work that is still going on there, educating the next generation of chemists in how to design materials and chemicals that are inherently safer for human health and the environment. But during that time, I connected with some of the funders in the field of environmental health that wanted to align their investments with their grant making in safer chemistry. And so the Forsythia Foundation was a real catalyst behind creating SaferMade. And through the Forsythia Foundation, I met Adrian Horton, who's now my partner at SaferMade. And the two of us were tasked with how would we help support safer chemistry getting to the market. We knew from previous work in environmental health where you can ban a chemical, but if you ban a chemical and you don't have a safer alternative already available, all too often you unfortunately get just the closest chemical cousin. You switch out BPA for BPS or 8-carbon perfluorinated chemistries for 6-carbon perfluorinated chemistries. And so the whole idea of SaferMade that Adrian and I were tasked with is how do you invest in those safer alternatives up front? And so after working together for about a year, we came with a proposal to the foundation and said, we think that an early stage venture fund focused at the intersection of chemistry and consumer demand for safer products can be a way to accelerate the adoption of safer chemistry. The foundation agreed, and that was the beginning of a 3-year fundraising journey. So it took us 3 years to raise our first fund, Adrian and I, and we closed the final close of that fund in 2020, and are currently still investing out of that first fund.
So what exactly prompted you to go down the venture capital path? And then why did you join SaferMade?
Yeah, so when I was getting my PhD in chemistry, I never had in mind that I would go into finance or venture capital. To be honest, I hadn't even watched Shark Tank when I was approached with the opportunity to help start SaferMade. It really just grew out of my work at the Berkeley Center for Green Chemistry. So I was presented with this unique opportunity. And my business partner, Adrian Horton, he has the background in finance. So he did his graduate work at INSEAD in France, and then came over here and worked at 3 or 4 different funds and family offices on the East Coast, and was right before SaferMade associated with another small early stage fund that was investing in the ecosystem around Yale University. And he wanted to focus more specifically on impact and on making a positive environmental change. And so the two of us had a complementary skill set. I really did bring the chemistry to the team, and he was bringing the business and finance experience. So we were able to come together to create a synergy between the two of our skill sets that really could evaluate early stage companies and then make investments. So we didn't join SaferMade. We created SaferMade from scratch. And we're still in the early days. So the jury's out on whether or not it'll be successful in the long run, but we sure hope so.
Thank you. And my follow-up question to that would be, what is the mission and vision of SaferMade and what led to its establishment?
Yeah. So simply put, SaferMade invests in companies that eliminate hazardous chemicals in consumer products. And so we look at that in two ways. The first is companies that are creating new ingredients, new chemicals, new packaging that leading brands will use to differentiate on safety and sustainability. Think elimination of plastics and packaging. Think elimination of silicones and phthalates and bisphenols in cosmetics. That sort of thing. The other type of company we'll invest in is brands that are bringing new technologies or kind of best-in-class ingredients to market. So we have brands in our portfolio that have better for you and better for the environment laundry detergent, better for you surface cleaner, compostable food service ware, things like that as well. So we see the consumer as the driver, but the impact is really always around safer chemistry.
Can you elaborate on the investment thesis a little bit?
Our investment thesis is that people prefer things that are better for themselves, better for their family. And that means better for the environment and better for their own health. And so that desire to find these better for you products is really what drives both sides of our investment thesis, both in better for you ingredients and also better for you brands.
So when it comes to impact, how do you define that and how would you measure that?
For each of our portfolio companies, we quantify impact first and foremost based on the amount of chemicals that have been displaced. So for every company we invest in, we identify kind of a baseline. What's the traditional chemistry being used today, and how does the investment we're making displace that chemistry? So as the company grows sales, you see increasing number of tons of chemistry eliminated. We also track other metrics within our portfolio, things like reduction of CO2, reduction of water use. We also look at the board composition and founder composition and look to support underrepresented folks and track that within our portfolio. Those are all kind of secondary to the primary impact of chemical elimination, but we see, our work as being adjacent to and part of the larger impact investment trend.
Thank you. That was very insightful. Can you also share two or three examples of companies that you have invested in and have seen positive impacts on their products and the environment?
Yeah, I'll give you an example, one of each type. So one of our ingredient companies is P2 Science. It's a company that started out of Yale as a green chemistry innovation, a new way to make flavor and fragrance molecules, and a new way to make bio-based replacements for petrochemical silicones and other additives we find in personal care products. So they use all bio-based material inputs and create ingredients for personal care that are used by Unilever and other large brands to eliminate petrochemical feedstocks to make sure that all their products are safe and biodegradable and that they still perform as well as the traditional products. So what we love about P2 Science is over the years, they started with, a platform chemistry. And they've really grown into being able to eliminate a wide range of things, including silicones, petrolatum, various additives to fragrances, including phthalates. And now, even in the world of color cosmetics, they're able to eliminate things like perfluorinated surfactants. Same thing in hair care. So, a wide range of chemistries that started from that original insight. The second example that I would bring up is Repurpose Compostables. So, they're the leading brand of compostable food service ware in retail. So, selling to folks like you or I, they're great for picnics and parties. And they use all waste inputs. So, waste inputs and then bio-based resins. So, they use waste from sugarcane bagasse and bio-based resins like PHA, PLA, and starch to make a wide range of products that eliminate plastic and waste in your own household.
So, do you have a variety of different companies? Could you elaborate further on the process of evaluating these investment opportunities?
We find our investments from a wide range of sources, great accelerator programs and like IndieBio and others that work on materials, think beyond plastics, as well as a large network of corporate collaborators. So they're not investors in our fund, but we work closely with leading corporates in each of the verticals where we operate because we know that bringing new materials to market takes an understanding of the industry that you're working in. And so we often bring them new companies and they bring us new companies. And that's another place where we find a lot of our pipeline. And once we've met a company, the process of evaluating them, we always explain it. It's kind of like peeling an onion. where it starts with, hey, does this meet our investment thesis? If so, okay, is there a quantitative impact that we can, get comfortable with here? If so, is this the right stage company? We're a relatively small fund, so we're looking to invest relatively early in their life cycle. So, if they're making tens of millions of dollars in revenue, it's probably too late for us, right? But if they're at the right size, keep peeling that onion. Let's look at the team. Let's look at the technology. And so it's really an iterative process. And so we start every year with usually about 150 new companies and usually about 50 returning companies and end up making probably two to three investments a year. So it's always a matter of right time, right fit, right team, right technology. And it means we see a lot of great stuff out there that just isn't a fit for us one way or the other.
Thank you. And beyond the access to capital, what value does SaferMade add to a startup? For example, connections, industry, market expertise, etc.
So there are a number of ways which we can help our portfolio companies. First and foremost is we often help them with the fundraising process, both finishing up the current round and also connecting them to other investors for future follow-on investment. We also can often help with connections to retailers or potential customers through our network of brand and retail partners. We also, on a kind of case-by-case basis, will become more involved with the company. So we have experience negotiating license agreements with universities. So we've done that with some of our companies, advised on IP strategy, in other cases, helped with identifying talent, especially when it comes to chemistry formulation talent, both folks to hire, but also, consultants that they can use to get products to market or reformulate. So like most VCs, we don't get involved with the day-to-day, but on a company-by-company basis and on an as-needed basis, we're always happy to be there to open up our Rolodex and really help people find the resources they need to keep moving forward.
You mentioned earlier that it took you 3 years to raise the fund. I'm wondering who your LPs are.
Our LPs are a mix of high net worth individuals, family offices, three environmental health foundations, so kind of our Catalyst Foundation for Scythia, and then a few others that work in the world of environmental health. And we have one corporate investor. Our only corporate investor is actually Target, the retailer.
What makes an excellent venture capitalist, especially in the deep tech space? And then how would you measure your success?
I think the first and most important quality of a successful venture capitalist in deep tech is a lot of humility. It helps to have a technical background, but even with a technical background, you have to know that the folks that you're talking to, the innovators that you're working with, have vastly more knowledge about what they're working on. Similar with the corporate partners, they have vastly more knowledge. And so you really need to approach investment from a place of humility and a place of interest, right? So what makes this job so fun is that every day you get to learn and you get to learn from really talented people. And so if you take those two things as a starting place, and then remember that your responsibility is to your investors. And so really take seriously your responsibility to find companies that are able to make money back for your investors. I think that you'll be well served in the long run because it is a long game to find out if you're good at being a venture capitalist. The eventual metric that you're judged on is the return of that capital to your investors. But along the way, you want to make sure you develop those good relationships. And that's where that humility, passion, and interest really all come into play. Because if people like talking to you and trust your kind of insights and advice, they bring you deals, they come back to you when they're fundraising again, even if you've said no once. You really develop a reputation that helps cement the deal flow and relationships that are really core to being a successful venture capitalist.
Marty, you talked about your investment thesis and a bit about your strategic approach. I'm wondering if you can talk about your risk appetite and assessment, as well as the expected outcomes. In other words, what is your desired rate of return and what is it that you're looking for in terms of multiples?
So we're structured as a traditional venture capital fund. So we are looking to return 5 to 10x what we're putting into any company back into the fund. That, you know, takes into account the fact that we know that all of them won't be successful. But over the course of the fund, you know, we're looking to return something along the order of 20 to 25% IRR back to our LPs. So those are kind of the benchmarks we're aiming for. I think what you need to think about when you're working in this world of chemistry and deep tech is that what does that mean given the fact that these are fairly long timelines for development of these companies? So it takes a while to get there. That means we have to be very conservative on the amount of money that it's going to take to get to that final exit. And we need to think about how we can support companies through that long life cycle. And I think that that is something that is a challenge, because when we think about risk, we do have to think about both technology and market risk, which is different from some investors. When you're working in the world of chemistry or materials, you have the inherent technology risk of doing new things and new materials, but you also have some of that market risk because you're usually investing in these companies pre-revenue. And so you try to limit that risk by understanding who their customers will be and talking to them. But the reality is, until they can produce a material at a price point that is attractive to the market, you're taking market risk as well. And so we think about both in our decision-making process and in kind of the support and evaluation of our portfolio companies, how are we reducing both of those types of risk as the companies grow, and hopefully how that makes them a more attractive investment for ourselves and others.
Let's switch gears a bit and talk about the chemical industry. I know Halima had a few questions about that.
Okay, so according to the International Energy Agency, the chemical industry accounted for 6% of global greenhouse gas emissions in 2019. Can you put that into context and compare it to other industries?
Yeah, so when you look at that 6%, it's actually quite significant. That is more than the CO2 emissions associated with the production of steel and the production of cement combined. So the, you know, emissions of CO2 directly from the chemical industry are something that need to be addressed if we're going to address, you know, that big third of the pie, right, of emissions. So you have a third from industry, a third from transportation, a third from kind of the built environment. And so to get that industrial third, we really do need to think about where our materials are coming from, how we can source them from low carbon feedstocks, and how we can make chemicals in a more efficient manner.
So the chemical industry has a bit of a bad rep, if you will. Can you list some ways, risks, hazards, etc., that the chemical industry negatively impacts people and the planet? And also, at the same time, reconcile that with the good that it has done.
Yeah, so the chemical industry has a checkered past. And it's important to recognize that at the same time that it has created pollution and health problems, it has also created a great number of benefits. So I think that, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about the challenges of the historic industry, recognizing that the chemical industry is going to be with us for the long term and that they are doing a lot to spur improvements and actually already have improved in many ways. But historically, the challenges from the chemical industry fall into a couple of buckets. First is their use of fossil resources. So the vast majority of chemicals, over 95% of the chemicals we have today, are direct derivatives from fossil resources. So they have that kind of environmental impact that they're coming to terms with in terms of sustainability. The second has been industrial pollution. So we unfortunately have a history of emissions from chemical production plants. So you have things in the past like the Love Canal or Bhopal that were horrible environmental tragedies. More recently, issues like the DuPont and 3M plants polluting groundwater with PFAS. So, you know, lots of improvements have been made, but there's still room to address emissions from these plants. And the third and final way that we think about is that chemistry is used in every product around us. And a lot of that chemistry is perfectly safe, but we have seen over and over again that small amounts of things that are often added for functional reasons, whether it's PFAS for grease and water repellency, or phthalates to make fragrances last longer or to make plastic softer, or bisphenols, which have been added for adhesives and also to plastics. These things have been impacting our health. They're the sort of pollutants that increase rates of cancer, increase rates of obesity. They disrupt the way our hormones normally function. And this isn't what they were designed to do, right? These are unfortunate side effects of the function that they're serving. And as we become more aware of their potential to enter our body and cause harm, consumers are looking for safer alternatives. And that's kind of the future of chemistry. Chemistry industry is already trying to address some of that sustainability challenge around lowering carbon. They're already doing a fair amount of work to make sure there's not emissions from their plants. And I think this is really the third piece that I'd like to see even more focus on in the future, which is how do we create the next generation of molecules that start from a different place and give us the function we're looking for without these side effects that we've gotten in the past because we're starting from the same petrochemicals over and over and over.
You mentioned the use of fossil fuels. So the chemical industry has obviously always relied heavily on fossil fuels, but supposedly it's trying to reduce that. And I'm wondering what is driving that interest in reduction?
So this is a fascinating topic. So there's two things going on at the same time. You have the large chemical companies that are trying to lower their energy footprint. And this always makes sense because of the double bottom line. If they lower the amount of energy they're using, it lowers their costs. It also lowers their carbon footprint. So you have a lot of initiatives at using energy more efficiently, switching to cleaner forms of energy. And that's great. Those are all steps in the right direction. The other thing that we have going on that we really actually, I think, need to address is that as we start using less and less fossil resources for fuel, we're actually seeing a build out of plastics and petrochemical facilities. So your large petrochemical companies, your Exxons and BPs, folks like that, are actually doubly investing in now making more plastic and feedstock for the chemical industry. So on one hand, we're trying to reduce the amount of additional energy we put in, but on the other, there's actually kind of a doubling down of making all of our stuff out of petroleum as fuel becomes less of a driver within the industry. And it's one of the reasons that we really do look, not exclusively, but when possible, to biological feedstocks rather than petrochemical feedstocks as a way to shift us completely off of that fossil resource. It's going to happen slowly and it's going to happen over time, but it is something that needs to occur.
I'm wondering what unintended consequences you foresee because of this shift towards more production of plastics.
People already recognize that plastic pollution is having a significant environmental impact and are beginning to realize that it also can be a way, microplastic pollution can be a way that pollution enters our food system as well. And so if we continue on the path of just producing more and more plastics, we are going to see these environmental and health impacts grow over time. And that's something that we would like to head off at the pass. And you do that in two or three ways, right? And we think all of these are investment opportunities. So one is transitioning, like we said earlier, to bio-based feedstocks and bio-based polymers as kind of the building blocks that we use for our materials. The second way is that we invest in reducing the use of the worst types of plastic. So not all plastic is created equal. Things like polystyrene and polyvinyl chloride are much more harmful for environment and human health than things like PET. So one of the things that I hope happens in the interim and something that we look to is investing in the safer plastics and the circular economy of those safer plastics, right? And you see this, it actually maps fairly well with health. It's very hard to recycle things like polystyrene and polyvinyl chloride. It's possible, but it's very hard and they often contaminate other recycling streams. Whereas the recycling of PET bottles into fibers and into other things is actually done fairly well. And there's a big market for recycled PET. And so technologies that can help you break down addition polymers back into their monomers so they can create high value, real, truly circular solutions, I think are exciting. Ways to better sort some of these harmful resins from the less harmful resins. Again, big investment opportunity and very exciting. And so that's the second way that we can kind of address the fact that plastics are going to be with us one way or another. Bioplastics or petroleum-based plastics are going to be a part of our material palette for a long time to come.
The UN's environmental program made a forecast about the chemical industry doubling by 2030. How does one even go about curtailing adverse effects of this growth? What will it take? What are some ideas that people are proposing, and how would they be implemented? I'm also wondering, are these ideas being implemented fast enough, and what are the barriers to that implementation?
It's true. Many sources point to the continued growth of the chemical industry. And this isn't surprising. It tracks right along with development, right? As societies develop, you have more consumer goods, you have more medicine, you have more disposable income, and that often gets translated back into materials. And all materials come from chemicals. And so the growth itself, we don't see necessarily as a negative thing. It's really what chemicals are we bringing into the world, right? So we don't have a problem with the chemical industry doubling. We just like it to grow much faster along some of the areas that we're investing in, right? So safer bio-based alternatives, things that are designed to be circular so that at their end of life they can be reused. That still allows the industry to grow even while dematerializing the impact. And I think the other thing that we like to consider is how do you invest in a future chemical industry that also has a smaller footprint and is more flexible. So one of the challenges is historically the chemical industry builds huge plants that they expect to run for 20 years. And one of the reasons why the industry is so conservative is once they build that plant, the worst thing that can happen is that they're not able to sell the offtake from that plant over the next 20 years. So we see a real interesting opportunity in investing in the future of chemical engineering and chemical manufacturing. How do you make it more parallel and less kind of aggregated in one place? How can you scale kind of on-demand chemistry as you need it? And we see some interesting companies doing, on-demand hydrogen peroxide, on-demand hypochlorous acid, on-demand things at facilities, at industrial facilities where they're needed. And I think that trend towards producing things that have the footprint of a shipping container rather than the footprint of, a city block is really an opportunity so that we make a chemical industry that is more resilient for the future, is more adaptable to new chemistries, and is less locked into this mindset of the only way to be successful in the chemical industry is to build these huge multi-$100 million, billion plants. The future of the chemical industry needs to be more modular and decentralized. That'll allow it to use local resources as feedstocks. It'll allow it to be closer to the consumer. It'll help address other impacts of the chemical industry and also create something that's more flexible for the future.
Can you elaborate on the role and responsibilities that established legacy chemical corporations have in advancing sustainability? What steps, concrete steps, do you see them taking to, for example, reduce their CO2 emissions?
So there are responsibilities up and down the value chain for companies if we're going to successfully reduce our chemical emissions. We talked earlier about the chemical industry reducing its energy footprint and carbon footprint. What's interesting is we see a ton of support from the consumer-facing companies. So for the folks like the Unilevers and Targets and Amazons even of the world that are actually delivering the products to us also have a vested interest in reducing and dematerializing some of their supply chain, right? Whether that's reducing packaging or removing plastic or transitioning to safer chemicals. And one of the things that we find is we love working with these downstream partners that are closer to the consumer because they don't really care what chemical or material they use in the end. They're chemical and material agnostic. All they want is the function and the performance that their consumer's looking for. So we find them to be excellent partners for piloting new materials and new chemistries in their products. They have concerns about price when it comes to the end, but it doesn't matter. They're even willing to pay a premium often in some cases if you can tell that story of safety and sustainability. And so while we see the chemical industry as being a long-term potential acquirer for some of our companies, our near-term partners are actually often the consumer product companies because they desire change more than anything else. They want to talk about these things and show their consumer that they care.
I appreciate you answering that by breaking it down into stakeholders across the value ecosystem. I'm now wondering how, if at all, SaferMade interacts with these legacy chemical companies. How do you deal with entrenched interests here?
SaferMade has a positive relationship with especially the venture arms of a lot of the larger chemical companies. So we're co-investors with some of them in companies like P2 Science that I mentioned earlier, and also in Green Theme Technologies, one of our textile finishing companies, has co-investors who come from the industry. So we like working alongside, especially their venture arms, because their venture arms are forward-thinking. They see the same trends that we do, that consumers and brands are asking for lower carbon, safer chemicals. And so while the industry writ large can get a bad reputation because they do fight things like regulation, the reality is they see the same changes we do. And so when you're working with their kind of forward-looking business development and venture arms, we get along quite well.
Last question here. Can you give us an overview of the regulatory landscape? What policies and regulations exist to curtail negative effects of chemicals? And do you think enough is being done by policymakers and regulators? Or should they step it up a bit?
Yeah, the role of regulation when it comes to the chemical industries is really important to consider. And it depends a little bit what part of the value chain you work in. But what we've seen recently is that regulations around ingredient disclosure, so you have that both in the US and even more so in Europe, where you have to disclose the ingredients and materials that are being used in your product, can be a huge driver for transitioning to safer chemistry. Brands and consumer-facing companies don't want to have chemicals of concern in their products, and sometimes they don't even know they do until they're required by regulation to disclose. So that first step of even disclosing ingredients and materials, we see as a way that regulation can really spur innovation without being prescriptive, which is also very important. We have also seen bans and regulations coming into place around plastic and more recently around perfluorinated chemicals, PFAS or forever chemicals. Those are all really putting some fire to motivate the existing companies to transition to safer things and to use less plastic, which is great. So those can also have a really significant impact on the way things develop. And you have to be careful because sometimes they have unintended consequences too and can be at cross purposes. Because we do also see regulation as a barrier in some instances. It took us 4 years to get a new insect repellent through the EPA. And that almost killed our little company on multiple occasions because of how long and how much money it took to bring this new insect repellent to market. We see the same thing with sunscreens. We think that, you know, the regulations in Europe and Asia are actually much more accepting of new active ingredients in sunscreens, which is great. And they actually often have a safer profile than what we're still using in the US because it's been so hard. The regulatory barrier and barrier to entry in the US market is so high that it's keeping these safer alternatives out. So regulation is a mixed bag, just like anything else. It can really spur innovation and support it when it's things like increasing transparency and requiring disclosure, but it can also hold it back when the bar is kept unnecessarily high.
Thank you again so much for taking the time to share your insights with us, Marty.
Excellent. Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation.